The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2016 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2016. You may make additional copies of this recording for use by your school, but please do not sell any copies of the recording. Learn more about classical Christian education and the ACCS at accsedu.org.
My name is Casey Schutt. I'm the assistant headmaster at the Academy of Classical Christian Studies located in Oklahoma City. I also own Mindhenge Artifacts, which we help schools market with videos, animations. They actually showed the most recent animation that we had in the plenary session 2 on technology and education. And basically what we do is if a school is interested, they can have the video, we put their branding at the end, and they can use it for their own marketing purposes. That didn't help the echo, did it? Or did it? Is it better? Okay, you're good. All right. So that's a little bit about me. Before we begin, let's open in prayer. Our Father, we are grateful for the collective wisdom and insight that abounds here. We pray that you would help us to take all that we've learned, that we would digest it and be able to apply it well in our schools. And more than that, we ask for your Spirit to do what only you can do, and that is transform our students. We pray that this session would somehow contribute to us being more true to our calling as classical Christian school educators. And we again ask for your help. It's in Christ's name we pray. Amen. So before I was at the academy as assistant headmaster, I was headmaster at Morningstar Academy in Iowa. And this presentation stems from work done at Morningstar. And you should have a handout that I passed along. If you don't have one, there's a few kind of floating around. Does anybody not have a handout? Oh, quite a few. I don't know that we'll have enough for everyone, but I'm gonna pass them back, and we'll hope that they reach you. And if you don't have one, that's okay. I don't think it's gonna be a huge deal. If you can look on to your neighbors when we get to the part where we kind of discuss this policy a little bit, that would be helpful. And if anybody just wants it that doesn't have it, I can email me and I can send you an electronic copy of it. So, well, one of the things, so formerly headmaster at Morningstar Academy, and this presentation stems from work done at that school. Now, what I really love about classical Christian education is that it takes an understanding of who God is, of who we are as people, of what creation is, and it builds an education, a cohesive education on those foundations. So it offers something very distinct. All too often, Christian education, and at least in my experience, has been kind of driven more by negative motivations. We don't want those schools, so we're going to create our own school. It's almost a way of avoiding other school settings, but not classical Christian education. It has this remarkable vision for education. It's a very positive motivation for the existence of this whole movement. And so when I arrived at Morningstar, that was certainly the case. But I felt as though the look, the aesthetic, the aura of the building didn't speak as clearly as I wanted it to speak to that distinctiveness. Okay, so we had this great pedagogy that we could explain. But when it came to the look of the building, I felt like there was slight misalignment. And, you know, the title of this speech is If These Walls Could Talk. And I believe, regardless of whether you take stock of your school kind of aesthetic or not, the walls are speaking. They're talking. They're communicating about the education that you're providing. Now, it would have been very easy for me to have sort of said, well, we may be a little misaligned there, but that's okay. You know, I'll just sort of, I'll allow the forces of consumption, the individual teacher preferences to kind of guide how the school looks. And also, I was slightly aware, although I'd become more aware, this policy could ruffle some feathers. I'll explain more of that as we get into this. So, you know, it was sort of like, well, do you deal with this or not? But in the end, I felt like it was something important to deal with. I believe that school aesthetic and decor, it was just too important to ignore, particularly for me as a headmaster, because my responsibility is for the overall culture of the school. And this is a big culture issue, right? Space matters. It matters a lot. Last week, I was at a conference at the University of Oklahoma and had a 2 to 3 hour break. And I went to the library and entered into this huge reading room. It was a magnificent space. I'd never been there before. And there were 3 other people in there because it's summer, nobody's around. And it was just amazing to read in that space and to study there. Space matters, right? And so that's kind of the impetus for this whole talk. Now, what we're going to do is, what I'm going to do is explain the journey that I took in implementing this policy, explaining kind of the philosophy for it, and then also explaining the basis or the actual policy itself. And then there'll be time for question and Q&A if you have any questions. But before we get into all of that, what I'd like to do first is situate this talk within the conference title, Repairing the Ruins, right? That's, as classical Christian educators, that's what we're doing. We're repairing the ruins, right? And I believe beauty, which this is a piece of the beauty, right? You think of the transcendentals of truth, goodness, and beauty. All things that classical Christian school educators hold dear. Beauty, though, of those three, beauty seems to be the most difficult to kind of get, the most ambiguous, the least understood of those three. But I believe it's vitally important. And so this topic is really dealing with that transcendental beauty. How do we make beautiful space of our school building? Greg Wolfe, who's the editor of Image, it's a periodical on literature and the arts. He recalls reading an excerpt of Alexander Solzhenitsyn's Nobel lecture that he gave, in which Solzhenitsyn quotes Dostoevsky as saying, "Beauty will save the world. Beauty will save the world." And Wolf, who was a college student at this time, was irritated by that phrase. It's like, what about truth? What about goodness? Why beauty? What makes beauty so special that it's going to save the world? And the phrase stuck for Wolf. And as he began to meditate upon that phrase over the years, I should say this too. One of the reasons the phrase stuck is because of who it came from. He says, these two great Russian novelists, known for their stern, prophetic, and intensely moral sensibilities, as well as for their stark depictions of nihilism and human degradation, applauding the redemptive force of beauty. And so the phrase stuck, and he began to meditate on it over the years. And as he thought about it, its truthfulness rang true in his mind. He began to see the truth in it. And so he says, this is in a book called Beauty Will Save the World. Whereas I once believed that the decadence of the West could only be turned around through politics and intellectual dialectics, right? Like argument. I'm now convinced that authentic renewal can only emerge out of the imaginative visions of the artist and the mystic. Okay? In other words, Wolf is now convinced that beauty will save the world. Or to put it differently, beauty will be a key piece in repairing the ruins. And he makes the point. Greg Wolff is a kind of a political conservative or social conservative, and so he's writing from that perspective. And he makes the point that progressives have made an impact in our culture because of their attention to beauty. That they've appealed to the imagination through story, through the movies that we watch, and the art that we consume, and the myths that we take in. That's what's shaped our consciousness more than argument and sort of rational discourse, which he says is what political conservatives too often focus on. But the point here is that beauty is extremely important for repairing the ruins. And so I believe this talk has a real important place within what we're trying to do as a classical Christian school movement. So we're going to be thinking about one aspect, one facet of beauty. Now, step one in the implementation of this policy was to convince folks that there is kind of a generally agreed upon aesthetic when it comes to how a school should look among classical Christian educators. In other words, this wasn't just like my personal idea of what a school should look like that I was sort of pushing on others. I've used the word aesthetics a few times. What I mean when I say aesthetic, aesthetic refers to the framework or principles governing beauty. Okay? That's what I'm referring to there. But as I read and conversed with other school administrators, it became clear that there was this kind of classical Christian school aesthetic. And the sentiment also existed in the literature that I was reading, the classical Christian school literature that I was reading. And I'm going to give you a few examples of that. The first comes from a book, Wisdom and Eloquence, by Robert Littlejohn and Chuck Evans. In that book, they say, there is no excuse for schools that purport to teach the absolute value of truth, goodness, and beauty, not to make their students' surroundings beautiful. And so what Littlejohn and Evans call for is an aesthetic that puts attention into the student's learning environment. Next example, from Beauty and the Word by Stratford Caldicott. He was a British, the late Stratford Caldicott. He passed away of cancer, I believe, a year or two ago. And he was, an Oxford professor. But he wrote this book, Beauty and the Word, a great book. And here he references Margaret Atkins' claim that good learning needs an appropriate atmosphere. And then he defines what that is. He says an appropriate atmosphere is one of calm, orderliness, and attentiveness in which deep learning takes place, facilitated by a relationship of trust between teacher and pupil. All right. So it's an environment of calm, orderliness, and attentiveness. Final example from Ken Myers of Mars Hill Audio Journal, which is a very helpful journal. I highly encourage you to consider subscribing. It's made an impact in my own learning. But Ken Myers was asked by Christopher Perrin what a school should look like. He said, what does a good school look like? And Ken Myers' reply is what you have here. He says, if all you're doing is transmitting ideas from one mind to another, then space matters little. If you're doing something bigger than that, something that honors their embodiment, then there would have to be a quality of order in the classroom and hallways. And he goes on to say that a school should not bombard with visual noise and clutter, and should maintain a beautiful setting. Okay? And I could give you more examples. I'm not going to kind of belabor this. Is this pretty echoey back there? Are you okay, sound-wise? I might just move it to the side a tad. Can you still hear me in the very back? Good? Okay. And I could go on. Just last month, the Searcy Institute published an article by a graphic designer describing a classical Christian school aesthetic. It was a great article. It was by John Buell, who's a graphic designer in the Dallas area. He's also the board member of a classical Christian school in Dallas called the Covenant School. Is anybody from that school? No? Okay. Just another example of this classical Christian school aesthetic, this kind of general sense that there is a look to these classical Christian schools. Okay. Now, let's move on to kind of the philosophical basis or the premise for this policy that you have in your hands. And we'll get to that in a moment. We're kind of working our way towards the practical outworking of this. So the premise that I have is that God epitomizes truth, goodness, and beauty. Now, how do we know that God is beautiful? Well, one clue is that he has created a beautiful world, and he has created humans with the capacity to make beautiful things out of creation, awe-inspiring things. My daughter is at this conference with me, and she, our normal hotel stay is kind of like a Hampton Inn, you know, just kind of your standard two-story, three-story hotel. She walked into this place and was just, wow, there were people everywhere, looked up, wide-eyed wonder. That's what people created, right? People have the capacity to create things that instill us with awe and wonder and beauty. And I don't even think this is the most, you know, fine hotel. But there's other things. You go to some of these cathedrals in Europe, the beauty that exists. Okay, so given that, God has said, don't make any images of me. Don't make any sort of carven, graven, don't whittle anything of me, because you will not even come close to doing me justice. No matter how great, magnificent, beautiful the things are that you create, they don't even come close. So don't even try. I'm forbidding you from trying to do that. Okay, that's how beautiful God is. Now, nonetheless, what he's created still speaks, however faintly, of God's beauty, right? It speaks. So I want us to think for a moment about what creation says about God, because, the testimony of Scripture says, I think of Psalm 19, for example, the heavens declare the glory of God, right? Creation speaks about God's beauty. Romans 1, Paul says something similar. General revelation is what theologians call it. So if we look at creation, we can notice a few things about it. It's purposeful. It's purposeful. There seems to be some sort of, there's a telos in the creation that we see. Things are not superfluous. You may see some weird little funky appendix on some tiny little insect, and then you find out that it serves this purpose, this unique purpose, right? There's purpose in it. Even things that don't look like they have much purpose. There's purpose in creation. Creation also appears to be very thoughtful. Whether even if you're an atheist and you're just calling it nature, the atheist is still oftentimes wowed by the thoughtfulness of creation. It's beautiful. Just take a trip out into the woods, go to Niagara Falls, go to the Grand Canyon, watch a sunset. Creation has a beauty to it. We think it's beautiful. And creation is well built. You know, I've never been in the woods before and thought, man, that tree looks really cheap. You know, what a poorly constructed thing. There's a sturdiness. There's a well-builtness to the things of creation, right? We may look at a human product and think, that's pretty cheap. But not to creation, not to what God has made. So if God's creation has such beauty, then shouldn't what we create share in that beauty? Shouldn't we create beautiful things? Shouldn't we do beautiful things with the space that we are stewards of, with the space that is ours, right? So that's the premise. And you may have questions. We'll hold all the questions to the end. We should have a decent amount of time for questions. So jot those down if you do. And save them for a little ways down. Now I'm going to move into the policy, which you should have in your hands. Did everybody get one? Does anybody not have one of those? If you could maybe look off of somebody near you, some of this you'll see on the deal, but the guidelines are what you're going to want to look at here in a moment. Okay, the beginning of the policy states, we want the impression we present in the classroom to be consistent with our classical and Christian identity. Okay, and hopefully with those quotes that I showed you earlier from classical Christian supporters and thinkers that are proponents of the movement, hopefully those demonstrate that there is kind of this agreed upon aesthetic to a classical Christian school building and classroom and that sort of thing. And I believe this policy reflects the standard. Actually, I'm going to make a couple other points. I have a headmaster friend who has gone on site visits to ACCS schools. And I talked to him about this in kind of crafting this policy. And I said, if we were pursuing accreditation through ACCS, would these kind of aesthetic standards be in the standards for accreditation? He said, no, they wouldn't be. But if a school was wildly out of sync with kind of what we think of a school should look like, the space should look like, then there would be recommendations that would indicate that school needs to kind of tackle this issue, right, as a school. And much of this policy, I mentioned that this policy was shaped in consultation with a number of other classical Christian schools. The policy itself was certainly influenced by a number of classical Christian schools, right? With their permission. And actually, while I'm at it, you guys may also use this however you see fit with your school as well, what you have. And like I said earlier, email me if you'd like an electronic copy of it. Okay. So, the heart of the policy is this. We strive for a clean, not cluttered, consistent, not overly individualized, and concrete, not ephemeral or fleeting look that speaks of our appreciation of the past and things beautiful. Okay? This is the heart of the policy. So we want cleanliness, right? It's an effort to eliminate visual noise that can all too often exist in a school building so that students can better focus. We also want there to be a consistency to the look of the building. You know, as I said at the beginning, classical Christian schools have this beautiful, cohesive, pedagogical vision that coheres. It's consistent. Shouldn't the building reflect that? Shouldn't there be a sense that the whole school is kind of on the same page aesthetically? So we want consistency. Now, that's not to say that teachers there can't be any individualization, but I think the feeling, the feel, which is really important, but that's so subjective. I don't know. It's an art, not a science. The feel, though, should be one more of consistency than it is of everybody's on a completely different page. Everybody's sort of isolated in their little room and they do what they want with their room. There should be some sense of cohesion throughout the building. I'll give you some examples of how this played out at our school. The head of lower school we had a number of bulletin boards in our school that were in the hallways. And they were all like slightly different shades of cork, slightly different. They just looked a little different, all of them. And so what she did is she did a great job at it, but put down a black fabric over all of those cork bulletin boards. So that anything that we put up there, there was consistency to all the bulletin boards, And the things that we stuck on there, the work, students' work and that sort of thing, really sort of popped off the bulletin. But it just looked nice. It looked sharp. Another example, and this was following the lead of a school in Tulsa, we turned the hallways into an art gallery of students' work. And all the artwork was framed, and we used all black frames. Like, they weren't all exactly the same, but they were basically just simple black frames. Consistency, right? That's what we were after. And next to the frame, they had their little ID card of their grade and the title of the project and their name. And then we also had some prints of classic works of art, but they were also framed in black. So when I talk about consistency, that's the kind of thing I have in mind. So that makes the building cohere aesthetically. Okay. Okay. I'm going to come back to the concrete piece because I think it's an important one to tackle alone. I'll explain what I mean by that in a moment. But first, I want to just look at the guidelines. So this is where it would be helpful to have that form if you don't have it, the handout. So the guidelines. And these guidelines are flowing out of that sentence right there. What goes up should be placed on a bulletin board or framed on the wall. A limited number of educational, not inspirational or motivational posters or items that are currently in use may be placed on a wall unframed. Now you may think, well, why no inspirational or motivational items? My thinking, and actually this is something that you'll see in a lot of these classical Christian school policies on aesthetic, this no inspirational, motivational. I can't speak for those schools, but I can speak for myself. My thinking is, I want the teacher to be the primary motivator and inspirer of the students. In my own school experience, like seeing Garfield read on a wall in my school never inspired me to read a book. But I can name four or five different teachers that inspired me to read. I hope I'm not stepping on toes here. That's not my intent. But so anyway, that's a bit on inspirational, motivational pieces. Moving down to the third bullet point. Now, as part of this process, and I'm going to explain the implementation process, how this went down in our school. But as part of that process, myself and the head of lower school, kind of did an audit of the building before we, just at the very beginning, walked around and just looked at different classrooms, kind of made notes of things that we thought were really helpful, things we thought were not. One of the things that we felt was a little noisy visually were some classrooms had all this stuff just hanging from the ceilings, like just, we just called them danglers. We don't know what to call them, just danglers. And so that's an example of something that we included in here. And one of the things we said, too, if you guys are having a classroom party or something along those lines, it's a special day, and you want to spruce up the room and have things dangling from the ceiling, that's fine for a feast day or some kind of celebration. But once the party's over, we ask that the dangling of the danglers cease. That was our policy. We encouraged plants and floral arrangements. Why not, if creation is so beautiful, why not bring creation into the building, right? Maybe they weren't always live flowers or live plants, but something that looked just like it, a representation of those things. We encourage art prints, important quotes, Bible verses to be framed on the wall. And you think, well, why framing? That's kind of a hassle, and that's precisely the point. We wanted thought to be put into what goes up on the walls, and so framing does that. Like, you're not just going to put anything on the, you're not going to frame anything. You frame things that are valuable and important to put up. So that's why we wanted them framed. Now, the exceptions to that would be educational type. You know, the alphabet would be an exception. In a grammar classroom, educational type things that you use on a regular basis. Those would be fine up up on walls outside of bulletin boards. Okay, I think we'll stop there on the guidelines. I want to come back to the concrete piece. And you may have a lot of questions. Like I said, hold those. We'll come back to any questions you have. I think we'll have a good time to answer. I want to explain something on the concrete piece. What do I mean by concrete? Let me make that more concrete. Basically, what it means is that we wanted something to we want what goes on there to convey what goes in the building and on the walls. We want it to convey permanence, okay? To convey timelessness to our students, to help our students understand that the world did not begin the day that they were born, right? That they have, that there is this inheritance that we want to pass down to them, and we want them to have that sense. And we think the walls are a great way to give them that sense. And so that's what we mean when we say concrete. That's part of what we mean. And one of my claims in this whole talk is that the walls of your classroom will induce speak. And I believe this concrete piece is a way for those walls to speak in a very countercultural way. Okay, and I think this policy, by the way, is very countercultural. I think classical Christian education is very countercultural. Let me explain what I mean by that. Okay, in a book by Christian Smith, a sociologist at Notre Dame, called Soul Searching, it's about the spiritual and religious lives of American teenagers. He wrote it in 2005. It's a great study on the lives of religious lives of American teenagers. But not only does it describe teens well, it also describes kind of the culture that they inhabit well. And part of what he said, and that we inhabit as well, just by virtue of being in, living in 2016, one of the things he says, he has a critique of capitalism. And by the way, don't hear this as like a critique of the entire system. I think it's a fine system. But there are some problems, as there are with any human-constructed economic model, right? So, here, you guys may have already read the quote. He says, "Capitalism as a system must ever grow or it will die. The intrinsic problem in capitalism's logic, however, is that actual human needs are somewhat limited and modest. It takes only so many goods and services to sustain a healthy, potentially satisfying human life. For mass consumer capitalism to forever grow, therefore, it must constitute masses of people as consumer selves who misrecognize new wants as essential needs, whose basic sense of necessity always expands. Consumer demand must always escalate if capitalism is to succeed." Okay, so in this kind of setting where the thing has to keep growing and growing and growing, we run up into a problem, and that is our own needs are kind of limited, really. Like, we don't really need a lot of stuff that's out there. Enter the Snuggie. I don't know if you know what this thing is. You've probably seen it if you've been watching TV late at night. Just since we all have had the experience of just being miserable on our sofa wrapped in a normal blanket that's so constrictive and restraining, the Snuggie is around. And what it provides are armholes that you can pop your arms through, and there's no more restriction. You're just free as a bird on your sofa, as comfy as you can imagine, or even at the campground, as the family and Snuggies are indicating. But the Snuggie, the product, I think is a symbol of how far this capitalistic enterprise has taken us. That it exists as a viable and even lucrative product is an indication of our frailty as humans. And there's all kinds of other products I could point to. I think Jerry Seinfeld, in one of his little bits, talks about being up late one night and seeing an ad for the Jinsu 2000 or what it is, kitchen knife. They can cut through a boot. And he remembers saying, you know, I could actually use a kitchen knife that could cut through a boot. I need that. But the Snuggie underscores Christian Smith's point, right? In this consumer setting, things are made, and they're made on a massive scale. And they're made cheaply. And we just have a glut of stuff, right? If in my grandparents' generation, the products just sort of dotted the landscape. In our own generation, those products have grown into mountains too tall for even the wealthiest to summit. And so in this kind of setting, just the sheer number of these things affects their meaning and purpose. And the material out of which they are constructed impacts their meaning as well. As Marshall McLuhan famously said, the medium is the message, right? The medium itself has a profound impact on what's being communicated. Okay, in order to highlight this, I want to look real quickly at a Christianity Today article that was written way back in the 1960s. When I was in seminary, I did some research where I was investigating the Sunday school movement, but it required me to go all the way back to the first issue, which I believe was came out in 1957. Start working my way forward. And in the early, sometime during the 1960s, there was this really interesting article. It had nothing to do with the research I was looking at. So I don't constantly get sidetracked by these things. But I couldn't resist this article. And in it, Richard Mao, who's currently the president of Fuller Seminary. So he wrote this when he was probably like a grad student. I mean, it's the 1960s. He writes this article describing this experience that he has where he's driving. And he sees on the back of a car, remember, 1960s, two bumper stickers. One is the Virgin Mary. And the other bumper sticker is the Playboy Bunny. He's like, what? He said, this threw me into this frenzied attempt to kind of absorb this into my understanding of the world. Like, how can these two things coexist on the same vehicle? That's the picture from the article. There's the two symbols. He said, maybe the uniting of these two symbols would provide a window into the spirit of the age. So he began to try to interpret, to glean what he could from this strange pairing. He says, maybe this was cause to rethink Richard Niebuhr's Christ and culture paradigm. Since here was the mother of Christ and the pet of Hefner standing in relatively stable confrontation within a single organism, neither one being quite dominated or transformed by or exalted at the expense of the other. Or maybe this was emblematic of the evolution of the 20th century woman from servant Mary to the autonomous playmate. And in Hegelian terms, this thesis and antithesis were dueling to beget a synthesis that pointed to some middle, even transcendent way that at once embraces and rises above the conflict. And then finally he says, well, maybe this was to be interpreted more as a prophet-priestly clash. Mother Mary embodying traditional morality and the bunny representing the new morality. They were sort of just duking it out. In the end, he says, I think this is just a case where the medium is the message. That's it. Here's what he says. He says, this is a case where the meaning is the message. These meaning-rich emblems are nullified by their substance, right? They're just plastic bumper stickers. They're fashioned by the same plastic and cellophane culture, a culture whose very plasticity allows for the real possibility that Madonnas and bunnies are mass-produced in the same factory. And Mao believes that such a culture sucks the power out of the sacred and profane to judge each other. Like, they don't even have any meaning anymore because of the medium on which they're printed. And so it is that images constructed of such material, they can peacefully get along just fine and no problem, because they don't mean anything. Now, so how does this apply to a classical Christian school? How in the world does this apply? Well, I think it does. One of the things we want to do is be unique as classical Christian schools. And we are unique. And we provide an education that has stood the test of time, which is a breath of fresh air, I think, for parents and other educators, even teachers that we're recruiting that are just sort of weary from the trends and the changes, the kind of blowing the leaves. The teachers just feel sort of like leaves blowing the educational winds. An education that stands, that promotes a model that stands the test of time. So how do we make our walls speak to that? How do we convey that? If these walls could teach, are they teaching that we hold an educational model that is that speaks of permanence? I think also this concrete piece will help our students perhaps avoid the pitfalls of consumption and capitalism. Seeing things of lasting importance every day, all around them, I think will have an impact. So that's what I mean by concrete. And by the way, what you find at a typical teacher supply store, now much of that material is helpful, it's educational, but a lot there's a lot of it that reflects the kind of thing that Mao was saying just becomes sort of meaningless. Just becomes meaningless, ultimately. Well, there's a bit on the policy, and I believe how it's countercultural. And if we think about formation and how it happens, poetic truth and how it drops. You know, I can give you some propositions, and that can sink into your brain, and you can memorize those. But how do we get those things to drop down? Way down into your heart. Well, the answer to that, it's harder to pinpoint, I guess is what I'm trying to say. How you do it. You don't just tell them things of lasting value are important and you need to value those things. You show it to them from the time they walk in as a 3-year-old or 4-year-old or 5-year-old. You demonstrate it to them. And the walls and the look of the building are a way to do that. So, there's a bit on the policy, how it's countercultural. I'm going to spend about 3 minutes explaining the implementation of this at our school. Hopefully to kind of give you a path, if you're an administrator, how you might do something similar. So, the 2012-2013 school year, I spent a year just kind of reflecting on. That's when I was talking to other administrators, reading up, kind of trying to understand where we needed to be on this. At the start of the summer of 2013, that's when we did that audit of the school and kind of looked at what was helpful, what we felt was not helpful, and kind of crafted guidelines based on sort of that audit. We introduced the concept at an in-service that happened before the school year began, before the 2013-2014 school year began. And then unveiled the policy at the second in-service of the year, which happened in late September. And that's when we unveiled the policy. But the policy wasn't to go into effect until the 2014-2015 school year. So still a year out, right, in order to give folks the time to kind of think through it and plan and adjust and even for us to kind of understand fully what we were asking for as administrators. When this thing was unveiled, we had some visibly upset teachers. I kind of went into this maybe a little too naively, but after that meeting, I reached out to those teachers and we met one on one, and we sort of had an opportunity to discuss what we meant. This wasn't like, you know, personal, that we valued. In fact, some of our best teachers were seemed most offended by this. And that, you know, So we had to convey just how valued these teachers were. Now, I said I made a misstep, and I may have made, probably made, you know, 10 or 15 missteps. But as I, you reflect on these things after you go through the process. As I reflected on it, this is the biggest misstep that I think I made, was I should have anticipated that. I should have met with those teachers the summer before to explain, like, this is kind of what we're thinking. This is where we're heading, you know, and get feedback and sort of have converse a little bit about it. I didn't do that. So I would, if you're an administrator, I'd recommend taking that approach. Okay, so I mentioned that I met with teachers that seemed troubled. But, you know, I said that the policy didn't go into effect until the 2014-2015 school year, a year later. But we began to kind of set the tone, I guess you could say, with the hallway space. And that's where we put up the bulletin boards with black fabric and started building the art gallery. And the art gallery is not complete by any means, you know, because we wanted real top artwork. Top artwork from first graders or kindergartners all the way to 12th grade. And so that takes time. So it's kind of a work in progress. But we at least began to kind of set the tone for what we were after. So that's all I have. Do you have any questions? Doors? Right. We didn't have anything specific. Most of our doors, I can't think of anything that was on any doors from the beginning. Do we have anything on? We didn't have anything on doors. That was just kind of a standard. Nothing on doors. And like I said, you know, this is more, one of the reasons the beauty piece is so difficult is because, like I said, it's an art, not a science, and it's hard to be uber stringent on this kind of thing. This is what we concluded. It's not to say there might not be a good reason to have something on doors, and you know, so you know, but we didn't have that problem, so we didn't even address it in the guidelines. Other questions? Way in the back, and then we'll come up closer. Yeah, we gave each teacher had $65 per year to do invest in classroom stuff, and we encouraged them to use that money for some of these things. We also, as a school, invested in hallways. Yes. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Right. You're a little, well, on the one hand, you're limited, and that's not good. On the other hand, you're limited, and that's may not be. Well, actually, what's interesting is you bring this up. I was reluctant to show these pictures of some classes because these are not classes, these are not our school's classes, but they're classes that I think captured the look that we were striving for. This is a school in the Chicago area. They rent space from a church, and I'll just go ahead and show you. You might not be able to see that very well, but, you know, these are, and I don't know how they pulled this off with their rental agreement may be unique in that they can do more with the wall space that they have. But this is what they did. You know, I don't know. Every school, when it comes to the look, sorry. That's the first slide, I believe, of those. Every school has limits when it comes to this. And so that's why this policy may not be fully applicable. You know, we had budget limits and just even doing sort of maintenance needs that we had with the building. But, you know, you do the best that you can. And that's what Evans and Little John say in that book. You know, you do the best that you can do with what you have and make it as beautiful as you can make it. You know, and so... Yeah, I don't know. I don't know specifically how you'd handle rental space. Question. Yeah, pause. Yeah, so what we did, one of the things that's in those guidelines, and I've had this conversation before, it feels like. In those guidelines, you'll see that there's a designated, like, creative corner that the teacher could do pretty much whatever it was a reading corner. And they could hang things, some people have, it was almost like a, sort of like a tent kind of thing in that corner. That was where stuff could happen, right? that was primarily for the lower grades. I don't know. So that's where we landed on that. Any other questions? Yeah. We had hallways. Yeah. Well, displays. Well, the bulletin boards were used for student work, and there would be kind of a rotating assignment on who had the hall, the which teacher had which bulletin board at what time. Well, I'm sorry. Teacher rooms do have bulletin boards. A number of them. Not outside the rooms. No, the hallways. Yeah. So now if a class, so the bulletin board would be for a particular teacher, they could put it out in the hallway when it was their time to put out things. Now, also there would be times where projects would you know, kind of more elaborate projects that required like tables to put out. Those would go out in the halls for a time being. You know, for a week or whatever, 2 weeks or whatever it was to put those on display. Does that help? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes. My, you know, the only thing I would say is, how is it present? Is it presented? What, you know, there's different ways of, you know, making sure that it's ideally confined to like bulletin board space, or if it's not, then it's sort of orderly, organized. That's where like kind of our concerns were, or our expectations were on the how it's displayed, not that it's displayed. Yeah, back here, and then we'll come up. Yeah. Well, and this goes back to what I said earlier about this being more of an art than a science. You know, I don't know I don't even know what your school looks like. I don't know what you guys are going after, what you're aiming for. For us, we just didn't use our doors in that sort of way. So it was just kind of a non-issue. I think it could be done really well. In fact, the school that I'm currently in, I think there's quite a bit of stuff on the doors and it looks just fine. So I think it would depend on, what I hope that you take away, is the philosophical basis that I provided. It's another step to get to the practical outworking. This is what you have in your hands is where I landed in consultation with a lot of other schools. You might reach a different conclusion, and that's fine. You know, that's part of this beauty thing. It's an art. We don't know. It's harder to, you can't quantify it. What's that? I don't think so, but I'm also even reluctant to say that too, because beauty is objective and it's real and it's not in the eye of the beholder. It's there, but our ability to see it's off, and that's where this ambiguity comes in. Now, you had a question. Yeah. That's tricky. Because the school where we were located is, you know, upper Midwest. It's cold and there's snow and boots and gloves and everything. We just did the best we could with it. I don't know if that helps. We had it all lined up in the hallways, next to the class of the teacher where it was. So that's kind of how we handled that. I'm going to take two more questions. If you have questions and you don't, feel free to come up. I can hang around. Also, email me if you have questions, or if you want that policy, feel free to email me. So let's go back here, and then we'll come up to right there. Too little? No, we didn't have that issue. But I will say, it wasn't like there was a single room that was just bare and empty. Every teacher did something with their space. Yeah. And then your question, last question. Fluorescent? Institutional? Well, I mean, windows would be great if you had windows. There's limits. I don't know. I don't know of any research on that topic. I know that some people feel fluorescent lights really mess with their mind and headaches and all of that. I don't have anything on that. I would aim for lighting as natural as possible, you know. So, well, thank you very much for coming and attending. Thank you.